You've got to be present and aware in that moment, and things have to sort of collide for your attention. But if those things do and it captures your attention and your awareness, then it can be a course-correcting moment. That is what happened to me.
Today, I'm joined by Dan Murray-Serter, entrepreneur, angel investor, podcast host, and advocate for mental health. Having founded 5 companies, including Hyped, his most recent venture, a brain care and human optimization supplement, but so much more. He's the angel investor in over 80 startups, a fellow podcast host. His podcast, Secret Leaders, one of the most successful business podcasts in the UK. Thank you for joining me on the show, Dan Murray-Serter.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. It's good to meet you in person at last.
Yeah, we've done a lot of stuff on Clubhouse during the pandemic.
Oh my
God. Anyone remembers Clubhouse?
Will they? That's a question.
Yeah, exactly. It's funny because I had loads of people always talking to me like, how are you on Clubhouse so much? What were you doing? And I tried to explain, my wife was actually pregnant during the pandemic. We were in lockdown. And she was, some women basically get this acute sense of smell. And obviously she had really bad morning sickness and everything else. So like for starters, she was unwell and was kind of like keeping herself to herself in a separate room. But she had this acute sense of smell thing where she couldn't be around any smells. We lived in a small flat in Camden. And so she was like, she wanted to be in another room away from her. When I was cooking, she'd be like, are you using garlic? Are you using butter? I'm like, of course I'm fucking using these
I'm
things.
Cooking.
What do you want me to do? Anyway, it was like 3 months of that. And so whenever I was like, you're on Clubhouse so much, I was like, I was basically on my own. Like, my wife didn't want me around, couldn't talk to me. I was in another room, couldn't go anywhere. Had my Clubhouse friends. Thank God for that. I think I would have gone mad.
That was a thing, Clubhouse friends.
Yeah.
Well, look, we're going to start with you, your background, your story, and come on to how Heights came about, life and business setbacks, what you've learned along the way, and how the goalposts may have shifted for you during that time. So
I've learned nothing. We can make it a quick podcast if you like.
This is not like marketing school with Neil Patel, Eric Sue.
No wisdom.
No wisdom at all. So starting with who was Dan? Let's go back there. Before business, before entrepreneurship, before Heights, you were in the world of advertising for 3 or 4 years, correct?
Yeah, true.
What are you doing in that space?
Yeah, so I guess my dad was an entrepreneur. And by that, I mean, he wouldn't call himself that. He had a business for his whole life from 18 to 67. So like one thing. And I watched him stress the fuck out, I swear.
Yeah, you can swear. I think James Haskell was the first person to ever swear on this podcast.
Yeah, sorry. So. I just have a potty mouth. I can't help it. I grew up in London. Yeah, my dad ran a business and he would have heart attacks and stress and, we would lose everything and then get it back a few years later. And it was just quite a tumultuous experience being the child of someone running a business. So I actually was so totally not interested in being a business person of any ilk. It was very off-putting. So the irony is not lost on me. So I literally grew up and I was like, are you going to go into the family business? Are you going to start your own thing? I was like, no and no. Like, those are the two guarantees. So I went into advertising because I'm a creative person. I love being creative. I don't have the greatest attention to detail, but I certainly have a nice chaotic, scatty mind full of brimming ideas. And one of my first jobs was actually working for Anthony Minghella, who was the scriptwriter and obviously screenwriter, famous director, did Talented Mr. Ripley, Cold Mountain, etc. English Patient, of course. So I was very lucky because I got an early education working for probably at the time the most successful British director right here in London, and that was like a real breeding ground of creativity. Then I was like, well, I'm going to go into advertising because that's where there's like super interesting jobs and opportunities for creativity. Anyway, after a while, without sounding like hugely arrogant, but I basically got promoted quite quickly. I was 24 and I'd been put onto like a whole bunch of major accounts, and I just kind of felt myself weirdly at 24 a bit like, I don't know how much more there is to learn here, or perhaps like I've been doing it only for like 3 years, so hugely arrogant. When you're younger, your ego is much bigger and then you get pounded down back to reality.
Beaten down,
But I was kind of in that space where I was like, I sort of bored of advertising now. Like, I wonder what's next. My best friend, Joel, who I still work with,
Co-founder of Heights.
You know, was working at PwC and utterly miserable, as you would be, and and was always looking at other opportunities, looking at market data, looking at what's cool. And he was obsessed with Warby Parker, who were like growing in the USA, and was just like, let's just drop out and do our own thing. So actually took a really good friend to say, I'm going to do it. Do you want to go and do this with me? For me to actually take the plunge. And I was definitely not going to do it. And weirdly, the sort of trigger that made me decide to do it is my father passed away. I suddenly got the whole, well, I won't be going into the family business now because it's not going to exist and it's not something that I wanted to do anyway. But then I suddenly started to have all these sort of, I don't know, guilt, emotional response to stuff and thinking, well, I think Dad would quite like it if I was an entrepreneur. And then this, you know, I think in life, sometimes you have things that happen to you and it causes a trigger, like, you know, a push, a step forward. And sometimes that's someone else as well. And I just had a few of them all happen at the same time.
Right.
And
okay.
So I was like, you know what? Now or never, I'm going to do it. You know, I can, for example, I'm young enough to like go back and live with my mum and, you know, not have to worry about rent, the fact that we don't have any money. And I'm pretty sure women find it hot to meet a 24-year-old living with his mum. So what wouldn't be great and attractive about that? Yeah. So, you know, all the kind of things converged. And I speak to entrepreneurs a lot, as you know, and I still think of all the things I've ever done, I still think that the scariest, most important, most stressful decision I've made to date was leaving my job. I just remember, like a scar, the amount of time I ruminated on it, maybe 3 months.
Right.
Like every day, like, no, I can't. Because the fear of not being paid, the fear of not having a salary, the fear of...
And there was no safety net for you.
Well, living with my mum. Going back and living at home. But to be fair, also, that felt like the right thing to do because my dad had just died. So it was sort of like partly that's very helpful for me and partly I want to be a good son and be helpful and around.
Yeah.
So those two things happen to, you know, I'd love to think that I'm a saint, but in this case, I think it might have had more to do with a sense of duty than anything else.
Okay.
But all this being said, that is a safety net.
Yeah.
You know, some people don't have that. Some people can't go and live with their mum. And actually, not getting a salary, not being able to afford rent is very, very stressful. So I think there's a lot of stats around entrepreneurship and how actually most of successful entrepreneurs are people who, you know, leave their jobs in their 40s after building up actual value in their life, both in experience and wealth, and having a mortgage and having a safe career and building an asset bank of insight and knowledge and expertise and then going and doing entrepreneurship, whereas the media skews it all the other way, right? Which is, it's all about in your 20s when you're free. And for me, I kind of, you know, I experienced that. I left when I was 24 and 25, but I still remember it, just all the pressure. I feel, you know, I still remember how much of a big decision that was for me and how terrifying.
Interesting. Yeah, because I fit into that other demographic that left. I was, you know, Virgin Atlantic 17 years and then I was always like, I'm going to leave before I'm 40. And then financial crash hit and it's like, well, I'm ever going to leave. I need to stick to what I said. I'm leaving now at 39. But interesting to know then, you're moving back in with your mum and deciding that you were going to start a business, given what she had seen with your father. What was that like for her, hearing that from you?
Well, she always jokes about how much Joel and I ruined her kitchen table. And, you know, she just has like lots of I think they're fond memories, though, because, you know, it was a dark time. And that was something like, there's almost one of those things, you know, metaphorically, a big chapter has ended and it's a dark time and yet you're sort of birthing something new that could go anywhere. And in that case, it's a career. You know, that business that we started, you know, didn't end up being like, you know, I'm not still doing it. But it's the start of something new in your life. So I think there was like a new beginning aspect to it that she was actually quite fond of. But yes, in reality, my mum, very risk averse. Not fond of entrepreneurship. You know, for many years, like, would always say, how's your little project going? is it time to get a job? You know, all that kind of like nerves. I get it. You know, she's always been professionally employed her whole life and still is at 75, you know, so it's just weird for her.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because, and that's just reminded me, and I'd forgotten about it, but my mum was the same. How's that little project going on? But I forget, and she still mentioned this. Yeah, pretty good.
Yeah, good.
But she, you know, we had this house in Canada. He was Canadian. She's Welsh. This house in Canada that then got, he'd put it up as collateral on a business deal, lost it all. Yep. House got sold for like $4 million to Donovan Bailey, Canadian Olympic sprinter. You know, it was, and she still quotes this kind of stuff. And it's kind of irrelevant to me because I was like five or six at the time. I have no memory of that. But it's interesting you saying that because that must have obviously triggered in her those memories, totally. The most painful memories.
And that's the thing, like, you know, as I've gone on a journey with mental health and trying to understand and learn more about, you know, the human experience, you know, I've been learning about trauma and reading books on trauma. And I never before I read a book on trauma would ever say I've suffered trauma. Because I'm like, I think those kind of statements are reserved for people who have really suffered trauma.
Yeah.
But actually start to learn, okay, there's big T trauma and little T trauma, and there's multiple little T traumas that can create humongous biases in your opinions and your behaviours towards people and all sorts of things. And, you know, for people like my mum and your mum and these experiences, some of those repossessions are big T traumas, but lots of things are little T traumas, and they're things that we don't even remember. Or not consciously anyway. You know, they might be sitting there in our psyche and our subconscious, like having some kind of impact. But anyway, I do think it's really interesting, right? And so, no, my career path, my chosen career path wasn't exactly her idea of sensible. But at the same time, I don't really have any skills. So it's one of those things where entrepreneurship is one of those weird ones where... it can be very good for a jack of all trades. Like I'm quite good at learning and I'm quite good at picking up new things. And I've got a great attitude towards failing and risk. And I'm a good generalist, but I'm not very good at anything. So most of my friends who are amazing at their jobs, like it's embarrassing how much smarter they are than me and sharper than they are at me at certain things. But, you know, I can pick up the basic level of a whole load of other things that they wouldn't even try.
So it's a very different thing.
They wouldn't even bother trying.
No, exactly.
Yeah, so it's just a different kind of skill set and it suits my personality.
And what was that first venture then that you went into? And what was that with Joel or was that when it...
Yeah, it was. Okay. We had multiple. so we've done quite a few things together. And what is interesting is we actually started three different businesses within a year. Which, you know, we're sort of trying stuff and it was working or not working. And we actually struck gold on one, which did, you know, before we knew what business really was, you know, we basically started a business, zeitgeisty, right? So this was at the time of Groupon. We essentially started a student Groupon. And because, you know, we'd been in uni like 3 years ago and we were like, well, you know, kind of understand the demographic and everything else. And yeah, we started the student Groupon. It just took off. And most of the deals that we were doing were digital and digital redemptions. So we were getting paid silly money for not actually incurring any costs. And there were just two of us and we were using a outsourced white label software solution from the Ukraine. So we didn't actually have any development costs. It was just a percentage of all of our sales. We were just basically printing money.
Wow.
And I went to this event. Joel was like, you know, we should maybe think about venture capital. And I was like, what is venture capital? I have no idea at all, genuinely. I don't know about capital. I don't know about... getting loans from banks, just don't know any of this stuff. I've been in advertising, so what is all this? People pay you for your services and you perform them, and to me, that's business.
Yeah.
And so we went to this event with this quite prominent venture capitalist, and we're going sort of around the room and people's ideas and stuff, and we told her what we were doing. She was like, that's actually amazing. Do you realise that? And we were like, no. We just thought, do you know, it's so interesting, the sheer innocence and naivety.
And you're in your own little bubble, too.
In our own little bubble. Yeah. And actually, like, you know, objectively now I'd understand that the traction we had in that one little bootstrap business was actually amazing. Mm. But we didn't know it because we were like, it's just business, isn't it, guys? Like, people pay you money and things should be like, you get some scale and it should be easy. And everyone's like, no. So once we realised that, but we realised people didn't actually really give a shit about our brand or what we were doing. So we actually sent an email to all of our users. We had about 120,000 at this point, and we've been going for 6 months.
That's just crazy, gone viral.
Yeah, it just gone viral, and we got really lucky. Like I say, it was perfect timing and everything, and hindsight 2020, because if I'd really understood those things properly back then, I probably would have carried on with
it. Scale the hell out of
it. But instead, we sort of like had a couple of £100,000 in the bank and like no costs, and that was just our money. And we were like, what should we do with this? You know, do we raise money and dilute and all this stuff? And we're like, let's just take it. So we just stopped.
Did you?
Yeah, we just like emailed our users and we're like, you know, it was Christmas, I remember. And we were like, you know, I can't remember exactly what we asked, but it was along the lines of, you know, we're thinking about shutting down. Let us know if you give a shit, basically. And no one ever responded. So we were like, well, 'cause no one gives a shit. So we just did. With that, bought ourselves, you know, apartments in London and sort of got on the property ladder and got going with the next thing.
I was going to say, you know, what did you do with that money then? Yeah. Did you split it between you and...
Yeah. And just like down payments for a flat and like getting on with the next thing, which ended up being Grabble.
Yeah.
So that was... that was a situation of, okay, well, we've now had a taste for this venture capital thing. So, and everyone else tells us that we're really impressive. So maybe we are. So let's see if we can give one of these a go. And so we started essentially, you know, to give the very quick version of the story, what became known as Tinder for fashion. And so Tinder was blowing up and we were both single and, you know, so we were like familiar with the user experience, let's just say, and decided that, you know, it would lend itself really well for shopping and e-commerce. So we built this app. It, after a year of absolutely nothing on, we basically built a website, nothing happened in a year. We raised some money. It was going to fail. We had 1 week till we were going to fail. We pivoted it to a mobile app with this Tinder-like experience, stripped away everything in the website that we'd literally just built all year and spent money on. And it just, again, went viral. It trended number one on Twitter. And fun fact, this was the moment that we met Social Chain. So,
what was it?
So Grabble was Social Chain's first ever client.
And no, I didn't know
yeah,
that.
Yeah, so that's how
fact.
I've known Stephen for like over 10 years. Yeah, exactly. So Stephen and Dom, it was basically Stephen and Dom, me and Joel. They were like, this is how you do it. They had all these like meme pages and all this stuff. You're like, if you want to go viral, that's exactly how you do it. And they were wicked. Like they were really, really great. Like we did exactly what they said. They helped us trend. It worked. Everyone was happy. Got to number one on the App Store pretty much overnight from nowhere, and had a whole bunch of investors who obviously wanted to invest, had ridiculous stories. Like it was such a competitive seed round that we had one investor who's still one of my investors and a really great guy, but a competitive guy.
Yeah.
So he was like, well, and he was coming in too late. So we were like, well, there's no room for you. I'm sorry. And he was like, well, what can I do? Tell you what, it was coming up to Christmas the following year, new Christmas. And he was like, I've got a billboard above Piccadilly Circus. You know, I'll give you that just like in between Christmas and New Year for like a couple of days if you let me invest. And we were like, okay. So we did this horrendous campaign, it's worth saying. Like we didn't have time to think about anything good and it was just shocking, but we did it.
Yeah.
And we were advertising Grabble and Piccadilly Circus and all this stuff. It was super fun.
I bet.
So we had a really, really fun journey with that business, but it was very, very stressful. Mm. It was always a great product and a terrible business. And I think what the last 10 years has shown is there were no shortage of great products and bad businesses over the last 10 years.
And was that your first experience of burnout, of doing something that just became relentless, you didn't enjoy it?
Yeah, so the problem with Grabble, honestly, was I didn't care. Like, right. I don't care about fashion. And actually, you know, my dad was in fashion manufacturing.
Oh, okay.
So, like, the space that I was grew up in was fashion.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, I don't care about fashion.
Yeah.
I like style, mm-hmm. but I don't care about fashion, like, the industry in general. Mm-hmm. And so I was just getting really bored of... Basically, when you work in a space, you have to become, ideally, don't have to do anything, but ideally you become a sector expert.
Mm-hmm.
People want to talk to you about your opinions, and if things are going well, they expect you to have more opinions and be up on trends, and then they'll invite you to talk at this event and that event, and you know, you can't just sound like a lemon, so you've got to actually start reading and learning what you're talking about. And I was just so bored of learning about fashion and fashion trends and mobile fashion trends. I didn't give a shit. So there was a side of it being like, I feel like a fraud, there's no shortage of people that want to work in fashion, that's for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
And we had amazing people come work for us, take salary cuts so they could work in a startup. Like, if you ever want to work in an industry where people are passionate, fashion is unreal.
Really?
Amazing. Yeah. You get just such talented people who they're just thrilled to go to work in the category. Yeah. It's really interesting. Mm. And I'm sure it's like that in music, for example, as well, right? There's just a few areas where people just like, they'll do anything to work there.
Yeah. So
I liked who I was working with. I just didn't like what I was working on. I couldn't be bothered with what I was learning. And as a result, I was just sort of like, you know, becoming apathetic, but also self-loathing because I was appreciating and aware of, I had a very fortunate experience of, we're growing, everyone wants to work with us, we're winning lots of awards, we're in the press all the time, we won awards at Buckingham Palace, and then we were invited to Buckingham Palace every couple of months for about 2 years. Like, there's just events that happen there, by the way.
Yeah.
And you're just constant, if you're on their radar, you're just invited nonstop. And that was happening to us. So I'm like, I feel like a dick. You know, I should be so grateful and so happy, but like, I don't like going to work. I don't like what we're doing. I don't really care.
Did you have like an office in, going into the office?
The thing is, it was always fun.
Okay, because it's in fashion. We were
like in our mid-20s. We had like, you know, 50 people in Shoreditch. Like, you can't not have fun. Everyone was getting drunk all the time. Yeah. Like, we were having a wicked time.
Right.
I just didn't really feel like it was my life's purpose. If that makes sense, you know? Okay. I didn't know that at the time, but you get a sense of whether stuff feels right or wrong. And actually, to this exact point, I went to an event at the Hoxton Hotel and a friend of mine was doing a presentation. And he pulls up this thing and it says Ikigai. And then he makes a joke saying, it's like my friend Dan, an Ikigai. And everyone laughed at me. but then he like proceeded to explain what was going on with Ikigai, you know, what you're passionate about, what you're good at, like what makes you money, what brings other people joy, yada, yada, yada. Mm. And as he's sitting there doing that, I was like, nope. Wow. That's really insightful. And that was the moment, literally the moment that I was like, wow, I am really not doing what I'm meant to be doing. And it just like hit me like a ton of bricks. It was super interesting. So I'll always remember that exact moment.
I was going to say, you can remember what you were feeling in that moment and the whole framework around it.
Totally. And again, there's like these, you know, trigger moments that sort of happen in your life and, you know, change the sort of course. There's an aspect of having the self-awareness at that time of your life to be open to receiving messages like that.
Exactly.
Perfect example. I've sat in many other events in the past where someone's probably stuck an Ikigai thing up in front of me and I've been just scrolling on my phone.
Yeah, yeah.
So you've got to be present and aware in that moment and things have to sort of collide for your attention.
Mm.
But if those things do and it captures your attention and your awareness, then it can be a course-correcting moment. And that is what happened for me.
Amazing. And how do you go then from having that, you know, screw it, just do it moment, aha moment, whatever it is, to then constructing this a vision to build another company, but this time in the health and wellness space?
Well, okay. So just to answer your last question, which I realize I talked for ages and didn't even answer. I'm not a politician even. So my experience of burnout actually came from working really hard and not loving what I do. And I say that because I do believe in working really hard and I don't believe in work-life balance. I think there's just life.
Agreed.
And that you should just live life your way. Doesn't have to be anyone's way. I probably work harder than most people. No judgment for people that work less than me. As long as we're all comfortable with it, it's my choice. Yeah. I enjoy it. It's not a problem for me. Mm. I won't get burnout at all because I'm loving what I do. But if you're working super hard on something that you really can't give a shit about and it doesn't bring you any joy, you're likely to get burnout because you're working really hard at something that doesn't feel right. And so I went from, you know, lots of energy to pure apathy. Like pure apathy. And I just couldn't get out of bed and I stayed in bed for about 2 weeks. So there is a screw it, just do it moment. So I see this Ikigai thing, and at that moment, I know what I'm not doing, what I'm meant to do, which is tricky because, you know, I have a co-founder, I have a business, we have employees, we have a runway, and I know that things aren't right. And so I'm actually, this is a perfect example as well of on the outside, everyone thinks you're doing incredibly well.
Yeah.
And on the outside, you sort of are, but on the inside, things are crumbling. Mm. So in the space of the same 2 weeks, this is what happens. I see that. It's then like some like London Tech Week thing or something. I'm doing like a keynote at Wired in between Google and Facebook. I was the middle one. Then I was doing some talk or event at Buckingham Palace. And then on the Thursday, we were doing the TechCrunch Europas. And I was so burnt out from feeling the stress of not being happy with what I was doing and having this sort of realization that the Europas, I didn't even go to. We were nominated for best mobile company in Europe. And then we won. We beat Depop, who were like the other like main darlings that everyone thought they were going to win, and obviously ended up being a much better business than us. but it was us or them, basically. And yeah. We won. And like, I just wasn't there.
No one there to pick up the award.
No one there to pick up the award. No. My friend had to pick up the award. And I was just at home drinking whiskey, feeling really sorry for myself. But then you get this weird moment where you won an award and you're like, oh God, this is just so cringy, because I'm like, can't even be grateful because I'm not happy. Mm. And then the following weekend, we were invited to, again, it's a perfect example of this world that just happens for you. Daniel Ek from Spotify puts on this conference every year called Brilliant Minds.
Yeah.
And every year it's 250 people invited to basically this palace and this castle, and then they take over this fairground in Sweden, in Stockholm, and it's crazy. And we were invited, so we went, obviously, and you're hanging out with these insane people. There's only 250 people there, yeah. So it's like a super tight list. Everyone you meet is doing this crazy shit that you're like, wow, I'm so inspired. So I'm at the end of this weekend, you know, feeling really inspired, but huge imposter syndrome, because like, not like we don't deserve to be there, which was one side of it, but just like, not don't want to be there. Mm. Don't want to be there for this.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it doesn't feel right. We actually were like, let's extend and go away for a day to a random island, archipelago, the correct term, yeah, in Sweden, in like for Stockholm. And we had a really honest founder conversation together of like, I'm not happy.
Just you and Joel.
Just me and Joel. I'm not happy. I don't think I'm doing the right thing. I don't think we should be doing this. And we end up having like, you know, all day just a really honest and open conversation. And this like week period basically triggered, you know, the series of events of screw it, just do it. And we basically decided to go to our investors and say to them, we're not doing this anymore. This is how much money we've got in the bank account. We're going to give it back. And like, we'd love you to go and, you know, do what you want with it. And the crazy story that not many people know, but is completely true, is they actually said to us, hold on, we'd actually like you guys to keep the money. Recap. So basically, we can restructure the company, mm-hmm, to make it more incentivizing for you, but we want you to keep that money, let go of everyone, shut down the company, but start a new one in the same guise.
I never knew that.
No, it's rarely, wow, rarely talked about. And, you know, obviously I've got a lot of investors who are very familiar with this story because they've all been involved in it.
Yeah, yeah.
But in a crazy, crazy way, Heights is part of the same company that Grabbel was. It's just a very, very, very long-winded pivot from basically saying,
wow,
I'm not living my purpose. I'm not willing to do this anymore. Mm. I don't care how successful this company is or where it can go. I don't think it's a good business, and I don't think that I'm right for it either. Mm. And we got to wind everything all the way back down to zero. We were given 3 months to basically decide to come up with a new business plan and explore what we want to do.
Yeah.
Timing was crazy because I was basically getting married. So I managed to get like an extra couple of weeks to just be like, guys, kind of awkward, but you know, I'm about to get married. So like, we'll probably need a couple of weeks there, not coming up with business plans.
Yeah.
And then we had 3 months from that moment to come up with something new, pitch it. I didn't really have anything that clear at the time, but we were like, there's something in this space. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in the background, Joel had experiences with gut health over like the last 2 years. I'd had experiences with mental health over the last couple of years. You know, we had personal experiences that we felt were relatable and worth exploring. And we went back to them with this kind of pitch, not for Heights, but for like, okay. we want to do something in this space.
Okay.
And we don't know what that is yet, but we're going to build an audience on a newsletter. And we're going to start a newsletter and we're going to start lean, just us, no employees, won't spend any of the money, but we're just going to see if we can build an audience and what we learn along the way. And we're going to need you guys to be patient because Rome isn't built in a day. We don't know where it's going, but you said you wanted to back us. The 3 month part, by the way, was we'll decide if we want the money back then or we'd just rather you get on with it.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were like, you know what's interesting enough, believe in you guys, just try.
And those guys are still with you to this day?
They've actually been bought out since.
Okay.
So that was like our venture capitalists. We were really lucky, which is that we've met. This is what happens as like with Heights as well. Very influential people tend to try the products, fall in love with it, and then want to invest. And that has happened often. Very serendipitously. And one time, one of those people came in and was like, I just want to buy out your VCs and be on your board and help you build the business. And she's been absolutely amazing.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, cool. And your relationship with Joel and having just spent the weekend with my best friend, what's that been like to be able to have that kind of open conversation that you had to realize? Did you know, was he as equally unhappy as you were at the time with Grabble?
Different. So... the thing is, we're wired differently. And I think what's super interesting, you know, we had this conversation recently together. What's interesting is as a professional relationship, we've been working together for like the best part of 10 years. And actually it is 10 years. So we started working together in 2013. So over 10 years, two people change. That's just how it is. You're not likely to be the same person that you are 10 years later. You hope not to be.
Yeah, exactly.
But like you will both slightly go off in different directions and gravitate towards different challenges. And I think that's something that we've reflected on more recently that's really interesting, which is, you know, our different strengths complement each other really well in business.
Yeah.
Like really, really well. He's very strategic, very structured thinking, very clear and concise and numerate. And I'm very like creative and hustly and, you know,
ideas.
Ideas, and I'll make things happen and, you know, like knock down doors and, you know, just do things. And it works. It does work together. But it's been really interesting actually having the meta conversation as co-founders to say, you know, are we okay? And we've actually even just recently decided to do founder therapy together. And I think that's a really interesting thing as well because we're, you know, really consciously aware. So for example, I started relationship therapy with my wife before we have a problem because I'm lucky that I learn from other people about stuff like this and people give you great, like amazingly generously, people will tell you, people that you trust will tell you things from their experience.
Yep.
And I'm sure when you interview people on podcasts, you know, we get this all the time. You hear amazing things from people and then you ignore them anyway. I resolve not to do that quite often. You know, with my podcast Secret Leaders, I get so much experience share from business leaders and I try and implement quite a lot of it so I don't make stupid mistakes that they have made. Like raising too much venture capital and never being able to, like, I've been super careful with how much we've raised, the valuations, and we're in a really good spot now because we didn't do all the things that we did with Grabble. We didn't do any of them this time around.
Yeah.
We're like really careful with how we fundraise, how we've made revenue, how we built a business. And so with my relationship with my wife, you know, doing relationship therapy together to make sure that we get ahead of having big issues. And so I had exactly this conversation with Joel recently, which is, you know, it's been 10 years. We've probably got lots of things we don't find time to talk about. Probably.
Yeah.
And maybe
we
don't, but maybe we do. And we don't want it to manifest really badly, not at this point of our relationship when things are going well, right? So I think what's great is we're open-minded enough to know that we have blind spots.
Yeah.
And we are definitely capable of telling each other the other person's blind spots. But then there's also what you don't know and others don't know about you.
I've never heard of founder therapy, but it makes perfect sense. Like when you're saying, when if you're coming up to, if you're being proactive, like sounds like you certainly are, like with your relationship with your wife, to do that with your business partner as well.
Yeah. And I've never done it yet, so I can't tell you what it's like. No, but I think it'll be really helpful. Like I really do. And I'm someone who likes to learn about what's wrong with me, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
From other people. So I can work on it.
Yeah.
But sometimes I think that but I'm still sensitive and I'm still a human being, and someone says something to me like with feedback and I'm still a bit like, oh, fuck you, even though I asked for it. You know, so you're a bit like, you know, doing something like in a setting like therapy gives the open space for you to receive it well.
Yeah, and to hear
it well, and to say this was the right space for us to do this, and therefore you asked for it, and it does hit different.
Yeah,
when you hear that stuff in the right place in the right time, it does just hit different because you've invited it. So I'm really looking forward to it, to be honest.
And I think also going back to your point about learning from having, you know, super interesting people on a podcast, the tool that a podcast is to enable you to have these conversations, it's like, I think we'd be doing a disservice to ourselves if we didn't implement some of that advice that we hear. And it's happened to me that you'll hear it for the third time and you'll go, okay, I really do need to go and do something about it. And it's usually something around like hiring or recruitment or something like that, you know, or whatever it might be, funding, that kind of thing. Yeah. But
or having difficult conversations with people early.
Dude.
And just like saying, as adults, there's probably stuff. We talked about trauma earlier, right? Like technically what Joel and I have gone through in Heights and Grabble and shutting down a company, and by the way, horrific behavior from a whole bunch of investors, you know, not all of them, like some of them have been amazing and some of them have been horrific because they're human beings. So you'll get the full spectrum.
Yeah.
There's little T traumas all over the shop and some of them might be unresolved. They might be with each other. Like just having someone there to sort of eke it out and be able to get it on the table will probably help some blockages be removed and help you both be better leaders with your team.
So what about action that came then? You get to go back to like creating Heights. I'm really interested because I know like community based, you took it from that angle and you've listened to feedback. And when it comes to simple things like designing the branding for the product, how did you come up with those initial ideas for the products when you've got the investors waiting for a decision and things like that? Talk us through a little bit about that. I think it's quite interesting.
Yeah, so I suppose one thing that I was really clear about is I wanted to design and develop Heights with Joel and a community. And so you can't just have a community. You've got to build one. You've got to build one on trust. And the approach I took was building in public.
Yeah.
So I was like, you know, from this moment, you know, I did a LinkedIn post about our company failing and all the awards that we'd won was the picture. And it was my company failed and this is why. And it went viral on LinkedIn and it was a really difficult article to write because I had lots of ego wrapped up in that company.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the invites to Buckingham Palace and places like that stopped and all of these things happened.
Right.
But you're just like, okay, this is good. I'm like, I'm doing the authentic thing here. I'm telling the truth. Like, not a genius, not any of the things that other people said I was, because I wasn't capable of making this a success, but going again. This is the moment from where we're starting, which is zero. People really resonated with that, right? People actually, it turns out, wanted to follow that journey and see what was going on. I think there's just something about, like, when you're winning all the awards and doing all that stuff, you're inspiring to people maybe, but not very relatable. And when you fail and you've got nothing again, well, you're one of the people again.
Yeah, you're right? Relatable.
So I actually found that to be a really rewarding experience, and I learned a lot in it. But we started to build an audience through writing this newsletter, and my process was, I don't know anything about this space, but I understand how the brain works. And the concept of neuroplasticity, so the concept of essentially absorbing new information through deliberate action. So by choosing what to read, by choosing who to spend time with, by choosing a different path in life, you will, by osmosis and by deliberate action as well, change your brain and change your brain in the direction you want to. And it can't happen like overnight. It just happens through habits and deliberate practice. So
yeah.
I started to practice gratitude. I started to read science papers. I started to read books on psychology. Slowly but surely, I was absorbing all this information. I started to go to events and conferences that were about psychology and about nutrition and about these different things that I was a novice in. I started to gain some understanding. And one of the things that I've always loved to do is write. And I decided, you know, writing a newsletter will be the best way to start this. So now, like podcasts, everyone has a newsletter. But it felt quite new in 2018. So in 2018, I just started writing. Every Sunday, I would sent an email that was three things from the week that were discovered in science papers. And what made my newsletter really unique for people was people don't read science papers.
So
my whole shtick
was... Handful of people.
Right. And I'd link to them. I'd link to the papers, but no one ever clicked the links. But I would write it in like plain English, make it fun, have some emojis. Like it was enjoyable. And people were literally learning what science says you can do to basically stay healthy, like look after your brain and your mental health, according to nutrition, neuroscience, and psychology. Those are the three categories.
Right.
And that's how it started. I just kept up that practice knowing that we're going to make something in this space. We just didn't know what. And so by doing that, I've always had a relationship with our readers, with our audience, you know, asking a question in the sign off, asking for feedback. You know, when we started doing the bottle design, you know, because Joel and I worked in mobile before, we knew a lot about user experience. So in hacking habits and user experience, there's something called day zero, day seven, day 30, which is all about your retention. And the only way to improve those things is by creating new tests and new little habits that you want people to, like hoops that you want them to jump through, basically to see if they retain.
Yeah, yeah.
And in supplements, one of the things that we learned when we were interviewing people was they would basically start a habit that they wanted, and then they'd get out of that habit very quickly.
Mm.
And one of the core reasons that people did that was they would just shove the bottle in the drawer.
Yeah.
Like if they're at work, they'd shove it in the drawer. If they're at home, it's just in the supplement cupboard with all the other supplements, and then they would like stack up, and then there'd be too many. And they feel uncomfortable about how many there were. And they were like, no, I can't take all of them. So we were like learning these little things that people were telling us. So even the bottle design, you know, we got to like, well, we're thinking about creating a new bottle design that's designed to keep out and make habitual for you. And do you think this one or that one, this one or that one? And the whole time you're really bringing people into the journey with you. And, you know, we built the whole brand like that so far. You know, it's been 4 years, technically, three since we launched. We launched in January 2020. Great timing. And
indeed.
But, you know, we were lucky because we were able to build an audience up just over a year pre-launch. Got super lucky with our launch because we got Stephen Fry. And we got Stephen Fry in a hilarious way, which is that he... one of our investors, who is the founder of WeTransfer, was
okay.
A lovely guy. It was like, I reckon, I know Stephen, I reckon he'd love the product. Do you want to send it to him? We're like, obviously, yes, he's a hero. sent it to him a few months before we started, sent him like 3 months supply, didn't think anything more of it. You never hear from these people anyway.
Mm.
The day before, that's how lucky it is, the day before we launched January the 6th, 2020. January the 5th, 2020, I'm with my mum and she is... And I get this email from Stephen Fry and I'm like, whoa, what? Long story short, he's like, you know, I've been absolutely loving the products, loving these little magic beans, as he called them. And thought they'd been really helping me with X, Y, and Z, but I've just gone on the website and I'm unable to buy them, which makes me realize that maybe they don't work at all. Maybe I've got stupider, which is very Stephen Fry, very funny.
Yeah.
And we had a password on the site. Because you couldn't buy it until launch day. And I was like, I'll give you the password so you can buy it if you give us a quote that we can use. And he was like, that's a fair negotiation. Here's a quote. And the rest is history. And being able to launch that day with a quote from Stephen Fry.
Priceless.
Priceless.
Yeah.
Because he's just in all of the different ways. You know, he's loved it by most people in this country.
I was going to say so many different demographics.
So many different things.
Yeah.
Young people love him. Old people love him. Men love him. Women love him. He's cheeky. He's irreverent, but he's clever. And but the main thing is you could not buy his advocacy. He's not an influencer. He would just say no.
Do
you know what I mean? He's just not like, and he's so trustable. And everything about it was perfect. So we got really lucky and we'll never know whether we would have made it without that, but these things in this space, when you're building supplements particularly, the problem in the space is that most of them are shit and use old practices that have been around since the 1970s, old encapsulation formulas and all sorts of things. Mm. They're just proven not to work nowadays.
Mm.
But the price is set low in consumer awareness. And so people think that all supplements should be cheap. But actually, if you buy cheap supplements, you're just buying cheap products. So actually, expensive supplements sometimes are even cheaper because you actually get the amounts you're meant to have in them.
Yeah, so that's key, isn't it?
Without getting preachy, it's one of those things where our job as a brand was from day one to try and build trust, which is very hard if you're a startup. Mm. So having someone like Stephen Fry, who is like a beacon of trust, made such a difference for us.
You seem to have had quite a few... serendipitous moments in your career thus far.
Yeah, little moments. But you know, it's my thing, and actually why I found the pandemic quite difficult. I've always said to people, you know, I believe wholeheartedly in serendipity. I think it's possibly like the magic word for my life, but you have to go and create serendipity.
Agreed. Yeah, you can't let it come to you.
Cannot let it go to you. You've got to just go out, say yes to things, be open-minded. And it's interesting, right? Because there's obviously the saying of like, you know, in your 20s, say yes to everything, and in your 30s, start to say no to more. And I think there's a lot of truth in that.
Yeah, agree.
But the point is, like, if you've been saying no your whole time, you're not going to meet people. You're not going to find new experiences. And I think these things are so important. And there's also so much more than just work. Mm. Like, I've got a whole bunch of Gen Zs that work at Heights and they just don't go out. I like our daily chat is pretty much like, what are you doing this weekend? You're going to go out? You're going to have fun? They're like, no, you're not going to. They're so wholesome.
Yeah.
And I'm like, just go have fun. Like, you know, I don't want to be the irresponsible boss, but it's sort of like the inverted relationship where I'm like, go and have like a party, go make some friends, like go do stuff.
Well, it is that thing, isn't it? And if you, you know, we're talking about on this podcast, getting from where you are to where you want to be, if you're actually not going to take any action, you're not going to remotely get to where you want to be. And that comes in with the serendipity and manifesting that kind of stuff.
And you know, meeting people and being open to other opinions that'll change your mind and challenge your ideas. They're amazing.
For those who listening and watching who aren't aware of Heights, what would be, and I'm sure you've been through a few iterations of this, how would you describe who Heights are and what they do at this point in time in 2023?
Great question. So now I will say that we make smarter supplements for body and mind combined. So we have two products.
I like that. I hadn't heard that one. Okay.
Yep. So we're trying to develop our proposition based on feedback that we've had.
Okay.
It's really
community
important.
Again. Yeah.
Really important. And we started on a purely brain message.
Yeah.
And actually, one of the most insightful things that we've learned from our customers, which is hilarious, is like so many of our customers will take our product and then also take a multivitamin and also take other things as well. And we're like, we're doing such a bad job on messaging. And it's because people are like, well, I take that one for my brain, so I need this one for my body. And you're like, oh, no, that's not actually right. So we've had to actually, based on feedback, develop our core messaging to be body and mind combined, so that we help people understand that actually it does both jobs. Mm-hmm. And we have two products. And one is the vitamins and minerals, so the nutrients that your body and mind need every day. And the other is a probiotic, so the bacteria that your gut and brain need. So everything that we develop is all about the relationship between brain and body.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the largest nerve in your body is called the vagus nerve.
Yeah.
So it runs between your gut and your brain and it sends communication both ways. But I think what's really interesting is it knows intuitively what to do, gut feeling, before your brain does. So actually some of the moments we talked about earlier where you feel something and you're like, huh, and then you kind of talk yourself out of it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, screw it, just do it. The motto there actually should be, you know, listen to your gut. Your gut intuitively gets the sense of what is right or what is wrong. And then if you give yourself enough time to think, you will just talk yourself out of it, out of cowardice. Not you specifically, but we all do it, right?
Yeah,
we all do it. You talk yourself out of it and that's your brain in action. So we're very much about, you know, trying to feed the nutrients that help you thrive from your brain and your gut. It's an interrelational system. And you need vitamins and minerals that you can obviously get from food and from a great diet, but it's very hard to.
So you need that kind of catch-all.
Exactly, exactly. You need nutrients to thrive. And our whole argument or positioning is, if you can get it from your diet every day, then do it.
Yeah.
Great. Most people can't. Similar kind of argument to, you know, there's a certain amount of protein you should be eating on a daily basis, and if you can get all that from your diet, do it.
Yeah.
But if you can't, have some protein powder.
Yeah.
Like, no shame. Just have some support as a supplement to get to the target. It's exactly the same here. It's like, this is the optimal amount and most people are nowhere near it. And being far off it, compounded over a long period of time, it will negatively impact you. Just the same way as being at your optimal levels and always hitting it will help you reach your heights, which is where the name comes from. And then a more technical answer is on the bacteria.
Yeah.
So for the probiotic, it's worth saying it's very hard to get that from your diet. So what's interesting okay. about my messaging and what I've been sharing with people from all the things we've been learning is I've always said, if you can get this from your whole food diet, do it.
Mm.
Do it. Very different on the probiotic side. It's just your stomach acid is basically more acidic than a car battery. So most of the things that you eat are basically not making it to your colon, which is where they need to. There's a term in probiotics. If you buy probiotics on the label, it'll say X many billion CFUs.
I was going to ask you that. It can be quite confusing, can't it?
It's very confusing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And all of this stuff is designed to be confusing, by the way, which really pisses me off.
From the companies that have been there.
Yeah, all of yeah, it. Yeah. All of it. Like, you know, for example, people say like NRB, which is like the term that people use for... like the amount of vitamins that you're meant to be getting, right? And actually, it's outdated. It's from the 70s. It doesn't really mean anything. It's not actually... It's the equivalent of an RDA, right? The recommended daily allowance. But that is the bare minimum, and it's way off the optimal levels.
Yeah, okay.
So one of the things that's quite challenging is a lot of healthcare terms and the way that people design products is based on concepts that basically came out of the 1970s.
Okay.
All right? It's 2023.
And therefore, why is it important to get our individual healthcare information from a variety of sources and specifically not always the ones that you'd like to think you're going to trust?
This is a great question. So it's difficult. I have so many of my friends are doctors and one of my friends is a media doctor, a very, I mean, arguably the most well-known or respected media doctor in the UK.
Okay.
And he can't say anything. He can't say anything. Basically, there's various bodies and they're all set up with the right intention, which is to not promote misinformation, right? So you go on YouTube, it's hard to discern the difference between what's right, what's wrong, this is opinion, that's opinion. I think it's important for people to challenge and question what's being said and authority. But there are limits. Obviously, some things are important for us and some aren't. The problem that we have with healthcare systems owning the space for where all people get their information is they're overrun. So just to give you a personal experience that is hopefully relatable for people, when I was suffering really badly with mental health problems, I had insomnia for 6 months, I went to the doctor. The doctor, which is a very logical place you'd go.
Yeah, anyone, 100%.
Anyone with a mental health problem that's listening, that's experienced a mental health problem, will have had the sensible thought, I'm going to my doctor. So you go to your doctor, your GP, and so I was given sleeping pills and antidepressants, right? Within 7 minutes.
Wow.
I said no to both of them because I knew intuitively that that wasn't going to solve my problem. I knew that wasn't right. And I ended up staying with insomnia for absolutely ages until I ended up seeing a dietitian, and she recommended me supplements. And I'd never even heard of supplements and mental health and why the hell that was related, but they worked. And she was very specific about the ones I needed and where I needed to get them. But the point is this, the doctor never considered nutrition. And doctors get 7 hours of nutrition training in 7 years in the UK, in 1 hour a year on average. So they're not trained.
We just repeat that.
7 hours over 7 years. Because dietitians specialize. So they do the first 4 years and then they specialize in diet. So technically speaking, what most GPs should do in these circumstances is say, I'm going to refer you to a dietitian. Maybe it's something nutritional.
Yeah,
that would be a sensible option. Or maybe that GP should have said, I'm going to refer you to a dietitian and maybe a psychiatrist. Maybe you need antidepressants. Maybe it's just your nutrition. Maybe you've had trauma and you need to see a therapist. Who knows what the thing is?
Yeah.
But that's not what happened. It was just take these pills. If you just go through the healthcare system, you'll get a very narrow idea of how to solve your problems, whether they're in your physical health, your gut health, your mental health, related to your longevity or any diseases you're having. If you go the traditional healthcare route, it's antiquated information from about 50 years ago that hasn't been updated. And that's why when you read modern day books on health, it's not like I'm, you know, with all respect to him, it's not like I'm going to Russell Brand and asking him for my health information. I'm going to like respected scientists and respected, you know, I'm going to modern day authors who are doing modern day scientific experiments and providing modern day information. And there's people inside the healthcare system are unable to practice medicine and say those things without getting basically banned from their practice. Whereas a scientist can speak, and that's why people can talk relationally about this. Say, for example, you know, someone who is an epidemiologist can speak very freely on gut health and mm-hmm. other spaces, because, you know, not speaking directly on epidemiology in like a way that might get them challenged.
Yeah.
So you can sort of speak about other areas that you're not an expert in because you can put the disclaimer. But when you speak mm-hmm. about in the area that you are and you challenge it, it's a big problem. So people don't bother. Mm. And that's kind of the thing. People basically toe the party line in this space. So I have learned to listen to my doctor and listen to health practitioners and use my own curiosity and agency to listen to other people who are on health journeys or are credited professionals in other areas who also share information. And then I can triangulate the stuff that I'm learning and see what works for me. Because actually what works for you might not work for me. Correct. And vice versa. But the point is, I think that there's a really important aspect here where people need to be curious enough to figure out how to solve what they do.
And then you've got the difference on focus on treatment versus preventative care as well, of course.
Yeah. So I think, and again, sadly for my dad, right, I've seen what happens when you get caught up in a cycle of treatment. Investing in little daily habits, little practices, ways to actually prevent getting sick. And it starts with information, right? It starts with being curious enough to learn what are some of the things that I can do. If all you do is, you know, follow sports news, football, footballers and all that stuff, you know, not actually even the health side, just the cultural side, and you don't take personal interest outside of that space to think about health and follow other people doing interesting things, you can get very sucked into, again, the wrong habits and behaviours.
Yeah, yeah.
100%. So I think it's just really important for people to try and have a breadth of interests, and one of them should be their health.
Yeah, agreed. And look, to bring this back, you know, voyage of self-discovery, personal growth that you've been on, that the life experiences you've had with different businesses, discovering your Ikigai.
Yeah,
I'll get there in the end. Yep. The Ikigai. Do you feel a vision of where you wanted to be, that early Dan, perhaps more interested in business, has shifted to line up with your strengths and true purpose that you have to be where you are right now? Like, do you feel that you're currently where you want to be? Or do you feel?
I think that's a really interesting question, because my daily struggle is, I know that the goal in life is to actually know you have enough.
Yeah.
But I struggle squaring that off with the ambition of entrepreneurship.
Yeah.
And it's my daily struggle. I know better, and yet I behave in the way that I wish I didn't. And I have all the things that I want, and that's very true. And I'm like, I'm so happy working in Heights, and I've got great friends, and I'm married with a baby, and like all of these lovely things. Mm. And yet I'm like, more. And it's just, you know, probably growing up in the West probably doesn't help.
No.
Right? It's just a consumerist, capitalist, like, intrinsic indoctrination of the things that surround you. And so I'm constantly trying to center myself and remind myself that I have enough.
Yeah. And what, is there anything you can recommend that helps you do that? Any practices?
I mean, ayahuasca is great. Quite an extreme way. So yeah. I do find psychedelics in general, I'm a big fan of therapeutic psychedelics, that is. Not that I've got any judgment on doing them recreationally, but it's not very helpful for this. But the reason for that is because I found them to be unbelievably deep at connecting you with nature.
Mm-hmm.
And nature doesn't want more. Nature doesn't want less. Nature just is. And without sounding like a total new age whack job, when you're on psychedelics, you connect with that sense of being one with everything.
Yeah.
And there is no more or less or anything. There's just being. Mm. You know, a tree doesn't want more, and grass doesn't want more, and the spider doesn't want more. It's just, they're just existing, like coexisting around each other. And you definitely tend to feel very connected to the whole planet, ultimately, and to like the real core of existence.
Yeah.
And that separates you entirely from ego.
Mm.
You know, your ego is the thing that's driving you towards more.
Yeah.
But like, at the end of the day, you're just a big ball of energy spinning around this ball of energy with all the other little weird creatures and plants that are also just weird energy. And when you take psychedelics, you're really capable of connecting into that feeling. Two books that I highly recommend, or two authors at least. So Eckhart Tolle.
Yeah.
So two of his books, The Power of Now and A New Earth, absolutely phenomenal.
Okay.
And then Michael Singer, who is maybe the more relatable version of Eckhart Tolle, who has a great book called The Surrender Experiment. And, you know, they're brilliant spiritual books. Eckhart Tolle is definitely on the spiritual, very spiritual side. Michael Singer's on the more sort of businessy spiritual side. He was the founder of WebMD.
Okay.
So he's been like a $1 billion founder, but going on a really spiritual journey his whole life.
Yeah.
And with it, I find hearing experiences and stories from spiritual teachers as well is a great way for grounding.
Mm.
Whenever I actually find myself really caught up in the desire for more and more and more, I put on one of those audiobooks.
Okay.
And they really calm me back down.
Mm, right. We'll have to link those. You've been an entrepreneur, I think you said like fifth company with Heights. How much an impact is prioritizing your mental health and doing the self-work that we've literally just been talking about? How much has that impacted the way you do business and consequently the success that you're having with Heights and success you're having in your personal life as well?
I would say that I definitely prioritize my mental health because I've built up habits over a period of time that all speak to prevention.
Mm.
You know, every day I walk at least 10,000 steps. I get out in sunlight in the first hour of the day. I drink coffee, which is good for your mental health if you aren't like jittery from it, for example. Yep. That's a body reaction, but coffee's very good for your mental health and for longevity.
Mm.
I, you know, obviously take my supplements. I drink lots of water. I exercise 5 times a week. You know, I do the things and I fit work in around those things, not the other way around.
I like that.
And I'm very conscious that, of course, I'm a human being. I'm busy. There are exceptions to those. There are days when that's not possible.
Mm.
And I feel it.
Mm.
You know, I notice. I think building up practices that work for you, so important. I know you do cold water swimming. I'm a pussy. Like,
yeah.
I can't do that. I mean, my wife dies laughing getting me into the sea.
Really?
I'm just pathetic, mate.
Oh,
I can do an ice bar because I can like dip in and out, but you know, the sea is just not going to happen.
Oh,
and I watch you on social and I'm like, fuck that.
yeah, it's so, like too warm for me at the moment. You know, it's like, not interesting.
No.
Yeah.
So the point is you do you and
yeah,
I do
exactly.
me. And you've got to find the things that work for you. And when you do, like lean into them and make them into habits.
Something that's interested me like with the background that I don't know about is you've also invested in over 80 companies.
Yeah, 81 now, yeah.
81 now.
Yeah.
What do you personally look for as an investor? Because I was chatting to Al Barrett from Grenade about this and what he would invest in,
he'll be the complete opposite for me.
Right.
So he'd probably invest in a company like Heights, to be honest. Physical product company.
Yeah.
It's his thing. Yeah, like my investment strategy has developed over a period of time, which is that like the reason that I do it. So like, there has to be a purpose behind what you're doing.
Yeah.
Like I have two main reasons. One, I love entrepreneurs and I know how hard it is in life to build confidence. Everyone thinks I'm a really confident person and I come across confident and all this stuff. But like everyone, I have these ups and downs and these wobbles. In entrepreneurship, you get told no so often and people tell you they don't want what you're selling and they don't want what you're doing. They don't support you. They don't back you. They don't care about you. And you have to develop a thick skin to it. It's not very nice and it's horrible.
Mm.
And so one of the reasons I love entrepreneurship and backing entrepreneurs is you can be the biggest catalyst for change in that person's life by just saying, I believe in you.
Absolutely.
It doesn't need to be a lot of money.
Yeah.
It just needs to be like, I see the whites in your eyes and I like, I believe you, mate.
Yeah, yeah.
I believe that you will go and try your best and do this thing and it might not work and that's okay.
Mm.
So I very much love that idea. Like I'm poor on time.
Yeah.
But I love that I can create that feeling for someone else because I've had that feeling for myself, right?
Mm.
So I've experienced it and I love the idea and that's why I pursue a volume game. So like I love the ideas, like as in I love learning about new ideas and things I don't know. So on the downside, for example, of our strategy, you know, a fucking supplement brand or a fucking energy bar, and like they're new twists on like whatever, but yeah. they're just commodities at the end of the day. They're products, and I'm not slagging off our own brands. I'm just saying, you know, Huel, like these are not inventions.
No,
but
no.
I get to speak to entrepreneurs that are like inventing new shit that never existed, like, you know, this new robotics thing and that, you know, stuff I don't even understand. I invested in this company that went to space.
Yeah.
I don't even understand what they do, but like happens to be a friend
Sounds
of mine.
Great.
And yeah, right. It does.
And you believe in him.
I believe in him. Yeah. And, you know, and they had a whole launch with one of the SpaceX rockets, and it was really cool. Wow. And they were so excited about it. And I'm trying to understand what the hell they even do, but it doesn't matter. Anyway, so it's kind of like that. I love the buzz of like learning about these different business models, these different categories, the different areas, things that I'm never going to do as an entrepreneur. Mm. And I get to feel part of their journey. So I do it for that. And then the last part of it is I've learned there's no way I'm going to be able to pick a winner. So
right. okay.
you go, you watch Dragon's Den, and they were very confident in themselves
Numbers
that they're
going
to pick a winner.
Yeah.
And you cannot do that. So I believe that I want to invest in as many people as possible as I can. And one or two of them will be outsized winners, and I'll get all my money back from those one or two.
Yeah.
And that's basically the game that I play. It's literally gambling.
Yeah, it's similar in a way, like Antler.co, I don't know if you know. Yeah, so I've worked with them quite a few times on different projects. Work as an advisor with them, and similar theory in that you're literally launching different locations, and you're literally chucking 100 people in a room, and you can create 50 businesses all over the world, and they're banking on the fact, as you say, that they might get a couple of unicorns in 10 years time from
it. And if you do, you do make back all your money.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I've learned not to, like, you know, think I'm particularly smart or capable of investing or picking a winner. Mm. And I think anyone can.
Yeah, okay.
You know, you watch people on Dragon's Den and they seem so together, and how they put it together. They're terrible too. They're rubbish investors as well. Like, it's virtually impossible to be a great investor. There's very few in the whole entire world.
Yeah.
So it's a much better strategy to pick a broader game, in my opinion.
And talking strategy to finish up again, I remember interviewing Al the last time, and they just sold to
Mondelez,
the owners of Cadbury, et cetera. Yeah. And I remember chatting to Richard Reed at Innocent, and there never was an exit strategy. Mm. Given that you're on your, you know, fifth go around with Heights, and it seems again, and you share it very publicly on LinkedIn, that it's obviously been ups and downs throughout the whole process, but you seem to be on that upward trajectory. Do you have an end game in sight, or do you have an exit strategy, or is it your 2-year-old daughter you see behind the behind the desk running the company in 20 years time?
Yeah, so I think a lot of people lie about this and say that they don't have an exit strategy, and they'll see what happens.
So.
And it's a very PC answer to give, and you know, I'm not that person. So absolutely, exit strategy. And I actually think, you know, again, learning from my guests, right? I don't want to be greedy.
Yeah.
Like, there's only so much money that you need to earn in your life that you can do anything with.
Yeah.
Like, I want to make sure that I get the business into a really good place. It goes into a good home that can scale it better than I ever can. I'm not going to be capable of doing that personally, but other people will be.
Yeah.
I, you know, genuinely think, you know, in the next 2 to 5 years, I can see Heights being at a bigger company that can do a better job of scaling it, getting it into more households and more homes, and feeling super proud of that. And that number for me doesn't have to be 250 million, 500 million, so I can have like this really amazing LinkedIn post. I don't need it. I used to need it.
Mm.
I don't need that anymore at all. All I need to know is that I've tried my best. I've had a successful outcome for my investors.
Yeah.
And I'm happy and fulfilled, and I've got time. And, you know, people always talk about money doesn't buy you happiness. But it does give you, and it's the thing that my guests say often, it gives you freedom to choose.
Gives you the time, doesn't it?
Gives you time, and gives you freedom to choose what to do next.
Yeah.
So, you know, as long as I've got that, I know that I'll be happy. I don't know what I would do next, but like, I'm currently really happy at Heights, but absolutely my daughter will not be running the company. No.
She won't understand it, but she'd be very upset to hear that.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Joking. Looking back to kind of bring our conversation to conclusion for now, what would you say has been the biggest takeaway that you'd share with the audience on how you got from where you were? And maybe that was back when the ego would have taken that 100 million, 100 billion, whatever it was, to where you want to be now.
Yeah, I think honestly, you know, having a child is a really interesting experience in itself, because you basically start to say, oh, okay, it's always been about what I want for myself. And now it's more about, okay, well, what do I want for my child? Mm-hmm. And actually, I speak to a lot of my guests who have extreme wealth, and most of them didn't come from wealth. So then they became successful, and now they have extreme wealth, and they're riddled with confusion and challenges about how not to grow spoiled brats, which is hard.
Yeah.
Actually, it is hard, and they actually worry about it. And so I've now had so many of those conversations. I'm like, God, that actually, you know, no one's going to feel sorry for them. Don't get me wrong. But that sounds horrible. It sounds like a real like problem. And, you know, you want your children to be happy, and you want to help other people in the world be happy, ideally. And so I think it's really helped me be like, well, you know, if I had billions, I'd be far more complicated to even, it would suddenly become a whole thing. And so, you know, I moved into a new house because I had a child, you know, I was going from a flat to a house, and we're there. And I'm like, you know, actually the goal for me now, and I've set this up as a goal for myself, is unless I have three kids, but I don't think I will. So if I have two, is to be satisfied staying in this house for the next 10 years.
Okay.
Regardless of the financial outcome. Because that will demonstrate to me that I really did understand that I had enough.
Yeah.
Like, I've got, they've got what they need. We've got two rooms for kids.
Yeah.
We don't need more than that. And it's all about ego, right? The need for more and more space and a better location, all those things are totally driven by this idea that you can.
Yeah.
So I think the opportunity for me is to try and keep my ego in check. You know, not get a better car, not get a better house, just still be myself. And there's a lot of these really interesting stories that come up about, you know, money actually, when you have lots of money, it suddenly shows your character.
Yeah.
Like who you were already, it just amplifies it 10 times.
Yeah, yeah.
So some people become really charitable and really supportive, and some people get enormous egos and suddenly become like unattainably weird. And, you know, I think that's a really great ambition to make sure that you are someone that your children can be proud of. And that is very different to how, you know, I might have thought 2 or 3 years ago, which is like, how can I show off?
Yeah, yeah.
That's very different.
And it reminds me, literally, when I was traveling last week and listened to podcasts, and I think it might have been your friend Stephen's last episode or one before, and he was talking about it again, probably when you first started knowing him in his mid-20s and early 20s, and he went and bought the mansion.
Yeah.
To show off to his friends, and he suddenly realised none of his friends were actually coming to visit him because he'd bought it an hour outside of Manchester or something like that, and he was just desperately unhappy. And I was like, wow, I didn't know that story. That says a lot.
It does, and it's really interesting. I spoke to Brian Johnson, who's like the health optimization guy.
Yeah.
So he sold his business for $800 million, made about $400 million. And he said basically what happened was, for starters, his friends, all of his friends would invite him to dinner and expect him to pay. Like, and you know, and every time they do anything, they expect him to pay, which is like, I don't mind paying, but it's suddenly a new relationship with your friends, which is like, am I being invited because of that? Or do they really want me here? And so you start to doubt that stuff, and they start to. And so what was really interesting to me is he said, everyone else around you acts really differently to you, whether you do or not. And so then what happened to him was, you know, then he, you know, he felt uncomfortable with that group of friends.
Yeah.
Because they just weren't like they used to be with him.
Yeah.
And I was like, that is really interesting. You always think that it's the person that makes all the money that then becomes the dickhead and all that stuff. But you never actually think about it from the perspective of how the group around you, probably now jealous or dealing with some kind of emotion towards you, just treats you as a complete other suddenly.
And look, before we go, so two products that you have at Heights. Any plans for any NPD or anything like that?
So yes, the thing that we're super interested in and been developing all year is in the kids space. The product development cycle is huge, as you might imagine.
Yeah.
So can't say when.
Okay.
Still very much there. But the way that we work is we bring on board specialists in different areas onto our scientific advisory board.
Mm-hmm.
So the guy that we're working with, Dr. Rami, he's one of the senior people at Great Ormond Street. He's a geneticist, nutritionist, gut microbiome expert who did like his PhD in indigenous tribes in the Amazon. It's just like a amazing doctor saving children's lives in Great Ormond Street. So, you know, our whole thing is like, we always look to find who's the most discerning, best person we can work with to make the product.
Yeah.
Because if it passes their test, it will pass everyone's test.
Got it, got it.
So our whole thing is like, it has to be, and it's a bit lame now because it's like, who cares, but witch, you know, like the witch thing. Mm-hmm. Was if there was ever a witch on supplements, it would be number one.
Yeah.
Like full stop on every single metric. So the way that we work that out is to find the people who we think are like gold standard.
Yeah.
And would just tell us straight, like, no, that's not good enough.
Okay.
So that it doesn't happen after the fact.
Indeed.
Because it takes so much time to make a good product.
Mm.
So you need to make sure that you're not having to change anything ever like that, right? It has to be gold standard.
To start, yeah. And, okay, so for those watching and listening here on Screw It, Just Do It, what code could they use to go to Heights and buy one of your amazing products?
If you use the code, making it up on the spot, but I'll make sure it's on the website, Screw It. Is that classy enough?
That'll work.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Screw It for 15% off your first month of a subscription of either products. And it's a subscription product, it's worth saying, which, you know, all supplements and probiotics and stuff, like the science behind them is you need 3 months for it to start properly working. So it's a commitment.
Got it. Yeah.
A lot of people feel impact in the first week or two.
Okay.
But the science is very, very clear across the board, like globally.
Is it 90 days? Commit to 90 days. Amazing. Dan, thank you so much for coming in. It's great to meet you in person.
Yeah, it's really lovely.
I've literally missed half the questions because I was aware I was running over time anyway, so I could talk to you for hours, but that was awesome. Thank you so much.
I could hear your wallet and cash balance just going out on the studios. So yeah, anyway, mate, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for watching this episode of Screw It, Just Do It. Let me know what you thought of it in the comments below this video. Has this episode helped move you closer to where you want to be? All that I ask is that if you enjoyed this episode and that it's moved you closer to getting to where you want to be, that you share this episode so that it helps one other person do just the same. Just ask yourself what small action will move you forward to get you from where you are, then screw it and just do it. Until next time.